Tainted Love on Pride Radio.
Hi, I'm Stu Smith, and as part of the LGBT Plus History Month, I'm going to be taking a look at gay life in the 1980s and the AIDS epidemic. We've got real stories and some shocking accounts of what it was like back then, so be prepared.
This person that was my friend, I didn't recognise anymore. It was just slowly fading away, and he sadly passed away 2 or 3 days later. It was awful. It was really sad.
The fear of AIDS has provoked attacks on perfectly well people, attacks which include arson.
Nothing in my training prepared me for what I was facing.
And I remember this older guy, he was going, "Don't worry, this is an American thing, it will never come here."
No one knew what the hell was going on.
It's hard to believe that we have stories like this, and it's only come back to light on the Channel 4 show It's a Sin, shining light on how bad things were in the 1980s for gay people. So the 70s ended, taking with it a decade of platform shoes and bell-bottom flared trousers, and paving the way for a fresh new shiny 1980. And what a soundtrack it had. Beginning of the 1980s, the music charts were dominated with post-punk bands. The Stranglers, Madness, and The Jam all dominated the commercial music scene, as well as the likes of this, which I loved. In 1980, London gave birth to a new gay disco, Heaven, a men-only nightclub in the West End, still going strong today as GAY. Clubs and drag bars popped up all over the country, and they weren't all exclusively gay, but the crowd were mainly gay men. It was slowly becoming more acceptable to be gay in the UK. From Brighton, Leeds, to the famous rock shots in Newcastle's West End, the dance floors of the UK were jumping. Was so loud that people's ears would ring at the end of the night as crowds poured out into the streets after the last song of the night was played. The lights so bright and the venue's revelers packed in so tight that sweat would drip from the ceiling. a club filled with a new exciting sound where gays danced, drank, sniffed poppers and loved life. Gloria, you're always on the run now, running after somebody. You've got to get him somehow. I think you got to slow down before you start to blow it. I think you're headed for a breakdown, so be careful not to show it. You really don't remember. Was it something that he said? All the voices in your head calling Gloria. Gloria, don't you think you're falling? If everybody wants you, why isn't anybody calling? You don't have to answer, leave them hanging on the line. Oh, calling Gloria. Gloria, Gloria, I think they got your number.
Boys.
The place was dark and filled with uncertainty. Numbers would get exchanged and toilet cubicles utilised for those who couldn't wait. Sex was rife, and there was always some new face that would turn a head or two. It was seedy. Sometimes bitchy and often inappropriate. Not a place for those who weren't accepting, but it was also a safe place for those who knew, those who weren't sure, and those who simply didn't care. If you weren't judgmental or prejudiced or simply gay or gay-friendly, you were always welcome. Fun was had, friendships were made, and sexual experiences were often tried and fulfilled. Well, what's wrong with that? There's no harm in it, was there?
Love on Pride Radio.
It was also a decade that would see the Tories dominate UK government after Thatcher's move into number 10 in 1979. The start of a decade would bring shoulder pads into high street fashion, new romantics into the music charts, and this by the Eurythmics. It was also the beginning of a decade that would bring anxiety, uncertainty, and death to society from an unknown killer. a worldwide pandemic that would change everything. A new virus that would cause panic, divide and breed discrimination. Although time would teach that it didn't discriminate who it affected at all, but back in the 1980s and at the start of it all, we were told that the way to get it was through tainted love. We know that the virus had existed in the United States since at least the mid to late 1970s. From 1979 to 1981, rare types of pneumonia, cancer, and other illnesses were being reported by doctors in Los Angeles and New York amongst a number of male patients who had sex with other men. These were conditions not usually found in people with healthy immune systems. It's 1981, and a 49-year-old man dies in Brompton Hospital due to an AIDS-related illness. The first death in the UK. He was homosexual and a frequent visitor to the United States. You're going to hear is someone I've known for a very long time. World famous, renowned drag artist, Ophelia B. Ophelia.
Hello, Stu. How are you?
I'm very, very good. Ophelia, I think it's fair to say that you are a drag artist that goes back some time and you are probably one of the most respected on the gay scene in Newcastle. And,
thank you.
And you know, UK worldwide in many cases. So when did you actually start your journey as being a drag artiste okay?
Drag artiste. I think that's a drag queen. I'm happy with drag queen, but my first like real drag show was in Rockshots back in about 1985-86 with a friend of mine called David, and we doubled up as a drag act called Too Darn Hot, and it started from there.
Yeah. Wow. So what was Rockshots and the gay scene like back in the 80s then?
It was scary. It was totally different. It was full of men with hairy chests, white vests and checky shirts, dark hair and small bottles going up the nose. I thought, well, that won't last them long. They'll be going to the bar. And then little did I know. But it was a brilliant atmosphere. Absolutely brilliant. Scary. Mesmerising. You've got to remember, Stu, there was no mobile phones. So if you needed to meet a date or something, you had to hang around. You couldn't, like, dial anybody or dial a dinner or phone a pizza, if you know what I mean.
When did you hear about AIDS and HIV?
Well, it was magazines that used to come out. There was, as I say, no online, so you couldn't just look at anything immediately like we can now. There was a renowned character on Newcastle gay scene called Lucy Lamont, and we sadly heard that she had been diagnosed with HIV, and there was lots of charity events happening. Body Positive North East was a key player back in the day, along with another couple of charities, but I worked a lot with Body Positive North East, and I remember giving condoms and things out on the street outside Rockshots, going up and down in the freezing cold, just trying to make people aware of what was about. And the big television advert as well, that always hits in my mind. It was horrifically scary watching that television advert about, like, just death, really. It was awful. And it was awful as well because it was labelled the gay plague and the gay disease. And for a moment, it was, but then people didn't realise anybody could catch it. And it was very scary. I remember Ward 25 at the General Hospital in Newcastle was a designated ward, and you had to knock on a door to get in and see visitors. And we'd done a few charity events along with Greta and some current queens of the time to try and make some valuable funds, just say for wirelesses and radios and little pieces of materials that they didn't have, just to make their final days a bit better. It was quite sad, and I lost a couple of good friends back in the day as well.
So did your friends at the time talk about it? Did they mention it? Was it a conversation topic? Was it something that, you know, scared the living daylights out of people? Was it always something that would come up in conversation when you were out and about?
It was. I had one good friend called Tony, and he... there was three or four of us always like knocked around together, and he said, "I've got something to tell you," and he told me, and I really like couldn't quite believe it, but at the time that said like a death sentence, you know. There was no like really, it was just a slow way out, and I said, "Oh, you'll be fine," and we went for treatment, and he was great, and he decided to leave his job because it was the best thing to do. He was getting tired. I remember helped move his bed from in the bedroom back into the lounge, and I thought, this is now, it's only a matter of time. And I went back, I always spoke on the phone, but I went back, and this person that was my friend, I didn't recognise anymore. It was just slowly fading away, and he sadly passed away 2 or 3 days later. It was awful. It was really sad point of time in my life, because it was someone who I knew, you know, and I knew other people, but this was actually a great friend of mine. And I haven't told many people, that's true, to be fair. I've always said that I've known people, but I've actually mentioned his name, and I really don't speak much about it. It was scary times, and it was great that new measures were coming in to find it more curable, and people weren't going to go through what they did, you know. So, I mean, now it doesn't really matter, you know, it's great. But back in the day, it was awful and scary. Especially for the gay community.
I remember, obviously, when I came out on the gay scene in the 95 period, there was a lot of taboo about it. If you found out that somebody had the virus, there was actually people on the gay scene that, you know, would, you know, be quite negative about those individuals, and it was almost like, you know, there was some sort of, you know, really nasty stigma attached, yep, to having HIV. Or AIDS. That has completely changed now, thank
totally
God.
Totally changed. I remember that, because and people go, oh my goodness, it was like a leper in the room, and I think this is so terrible. It really, really is. And that's, sorry for being so forward there and harsh, but it was. People felt like cast away, and we needed to do something to get these people back into the form of like, it's all right, you're okay, you're going to be great, you know, and that's what it is now, you know. And I remember being in a bar in town and with a friend, and he went, I've just looked around this room and there's five people that have HIV, and I went, okay, why not? It's a life, live it.
Well, that's it, absolutely. It's no different to any other disease now, and it's great that because of the hard work from, you know, the gay community and our people, everything that, you know, we've done to sort of educate others within the community about the whole thing, it hasn't got so much that stigma that it used to have back in the 90s, which I think, mm-hmm, is absolutely phenomenal. But I remember back in the 90s, it was definitely perceived to be a death sentence if you contracted it. And I think that probably had something to do with the medications that were available at the time. I know it was AZT, and I was, mm-hmm, one of them. I just knew them as combination therapies. I didn't really know an awful lot about them, but obviously I DJed with somebody that was quite savvied up.
See, I was a young twink back in the day, Stu.
Yeah, well, this is it. How old are you now, I feel, if you don't mind me asking?
32 and a little bit extra.
There you go. You're a little bit younger than me. Wow. Well, I tell you what, you look amazing for it. And the great thing about it as well is you genuinely are one of these people that I feel that I've known throughout my whole experience on the gay scene. And you've just went from strength to strength. You really have. You've just rocketed it. You know, you're bigger than ever, if you like, you know. You're
always a prominent feature. It's the lockdown. I'm quite humble in a way, and it wasn't until last year. But I forgot where I've been, what I've done, and it wasn't until I was with Vivian and Bagger last year, co-hosting a show with them. We managed to get a few dates in that people were, oh, I've heard of you, oh, it's you, blah. And I'm going, how do these people know me? And this is in London and Nottingham and Cardiff, and I'm going, OMG. And I'm thinking, really, I forgot about what I've done, where I've been, who I've met, the places I've done. And you do, though. And I thought, God, I've been doing this for ages, you know. And but it's all good, but you forget how much you've actually done. And I never praise myself, and I never do, but there's a lot of people remind me just what you're doing now, and it's nice, so thank you.
I was mistaken.
This is Tainted Love on Pride Radio with me, Stu Smith. As part of the LGBT plus History Month, we are looking back at life in the 1980s. Margaret Thatcher's government introduced its highly controversial Section 28 legislation, sometimes known as Clause 28. The clause, part of the Local Government Act of 1998, banned the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities and in British schools. Across the UK, there were high levels of homophobia. Section 28 was introduced following a difficult period for the LGBT plus community in the UK. There had been some progress, but the outbreak of HIV/AIDS led to the widespread demonisation of gay and bisexual men in the 1980s. The Conservative Party capitalised on the anti-gay sentiment. In the run-up to the 1987 general election, they issued posters claiming that the Labour Party wanted LGBT plus friendly books like Young, Gay and Proud and The Milkman's on His Way to be read in schools. In 1987, a British social attitude survey found that three-quarters of the population thought homosexuality was always or mostly wrong. Just 11% said it was never wrong. The anti-LGBT plus legislation left teachers afraid to broach LGBT plus issues in schools. Soon after the Tories were re-elected, Tory MP David Wilshire put forward an amendment to the new local government bill, known first as Clause 27 and later as the notorious Section 28.
Too often, our children don't get the education they need, the education they deserve. And in the inner cities, where youngsters must have a decent education if they are to have a better future, that opportunity is all too often snatched from them by hard left education authorities and extremist teachers. Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay. All of those children are being cheated of a sound start in life. Yes, cheated.
The fear of AIDS has led the Football Association to ban communal bars and to advise against kissing on the pitch.
The fear of AIDS has made some churchgoers refuse to drink from the communion chalice.
The fear of AIDS has provoked attacks on perfectly well people, attacks which include us.
Tainted Love on Pride Radio.
The effects of Section 28 soon became apparent, with some schools and councils shutting down LGBT plus youth support groups. And many teachers, too, afraid to teach about same-sex relationships. The legislation was ultimately repeated in 2003, and David Cameron issued an apology for the harm it done back in 2009. But despite this, its implications are still felt far and wide. Teaching about LGBT plus issues still remains a taboo topic in many schools. Section 28 was so divisive as a piece of legislation that a group of lesbians protested against it by abseiling into the House of Lords as it was being debated. Then, the night before it became law, four others invaded a live BBC news broadcast. Being gay or lesbian in the early 80s was completely different to today, says Buan Temple. She is one of the team who forced their way into a BBC news studio in 1988.
BBC has begun an inquiry into how four women demonstrators were able to get into the 6 o'clock television news studio and attempt to disrupt the start of tonight's programme. They were protesting against a new law, which comes into effect at midnight, stopping local councils from promoting homosexuality.
It was clear to viewers from the start of the 6 o'clock news that something was wrong.
Good evening, the headlines at 6 o'clock. In the House of Lords, a vote is taking place now on a challenge to the poll tax. Tory rebels have said that the tax...
Sue Lawley apologised and continued to broadcast. Out of vision, her co-presenter Nicholas Witchell and other BBC staff restrained the protesters. Outside the studio, one woman who'd handcuffed herself to camera cables was cut free. Another and the piece of studio furniture she'd handcuffed herself to were parted in a corridor. Led away, the women repeated their protest.
Protesting about rights for lesbian and gay people.
My head is in a spin, my feet don't touch the ground. Because you're near to me, my head goes round and round. My knees are shaking, baby, my heart it beats like a drum.
Next up, we have the programme officer of the Terence Higgins Trust, Alex Sparrowhawk. How is the trust set up then, Alex?
Terence Higgins Trust was set up by the partner and friends of Terry Higgins, and he was one of the first people to die of AIDS, sadly, in 1982. And Terry's partner and his friends saw what AIDS had done to him, and they didn't want other people to go through those experiences. So they formed the trust, and about a year later, it was given charitable status, and it's kind of been going on ever since. And in the early days, it was very much about sort of like counselling and helping people to sort of like live comfortably. The helpline was set up to help people with questions they had about AIDS and then HIV. And then it's grown from there, and it turned into a campaigning organisation as well. And really, you know, we're approaching our 40th anniversary, you know, next year. And we're still out there. We're still trying to kind of debunk the same myths that we were 40 yeah. years ago, yeah. sadly, because one of the biggest issues that people have always faced, and that hasn't changed sadly, is like the stigma around HIV. And
I was just going to say, does that still exist then, the stigma?
There's a couple of things. More people are aware of HIV and what it means today. But at the same time, that also means that some people think it's almost gone away and that it isn't an issue anymore. And then the other side of things is that some people are able to build a better resilience to sort of like the ignorance that still exists. But that's not true of everyone living with HIV. So it's really important that organisations like Terence Higgins Trust are around to support people who are still struggling to come to terms with their status, or for people who are newly diagnosed and have questions, or, you know, for those who are ageing with HIV and just want some support and you know, that ability to connect to other people who have the same lived experiences.
So Alex, when did you find out about your personal status?
So I was diagnosed with HIV in 2009. I'd had a few instances where condoms weren't always used, and then I became ill during the summer of that year for a couple of weeks. It was like having a really bad flu, and at the time I was sort of like worried about different things. I did have an HIV test, but basically what I now know is that it was too soon from when I first got HIV for the test to pick it up. So I kind of got better after that initial illness, but for kind of weeks and months I had this ongoing cough that just didn't go away.
Yeah.
So a few months later, I was still worried about it. I'd been to see my GP a few times and nothing was getting rid of this cough and this feeling in my throat. So I went back to the sexual health clinic and I had another test. And about a week after that test, they rang me up and asked me to come back in.
Right.
And it was probably during that phone call that it started to dawn on me that it might be HIV. And it went from there, really. Went to the hospital the next morning, to the clinic, and the nurse kind of took me into a room and sat me down and just said, you know, like, last week we did a few tests, one of them was for HIV and that's come back positive.
What's the general sort of response from somebody when you turn around and say, look, there's a thing called PrEP and this could potentially be available? I would suggest that would almost be like a little bit of a relief status to somebody who is potentially worried about contracting the virus.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's great that we've got another HIV prevention tool. Mm. And for so long, we relied only on condoms. And now we know that there's other things that can stop HIV as well. And I think that does give peace of mind to so many people. So you've got condoms, you've got PrEP. People like myself who are taking treatment can't pass HIV on. So there's so much now there. And what underpins all of this is HIV testing. So all of this works by knowing your status, which is why we recommend the most important thing to do is to test regularly.
Yeah.
And there's so many different ways to test now as well. You know, you can even test at home. You can, you know, ordinarily outside of the pandemic, you'd be able to test in a clinic, you know, in your GP, that kind of thing. But there's all sorts of different types of tests out there now, and it's really making testing easier for people, more accessible.
So somebody's worried right now, sat there listening to the radio, really worried, what's the first thing that they do?
They need to think about, what are they worried because of something they've done, or are they just worried out of a general fear around the virus itself? But I would encourage them to get a test. I'd get them to think about what it might mean if they found out they did have HIV. Who would they be able to talk to about it? Do they have someone that's able to support them straight away and then make their decision from there? But definitely to get tested, but to think about who you might talk to afterwards. Maybe look up what your local organisation is, or, you know, take a look at the information on our website, for example. I think it's important to stress that the vast, vast majority of tests come back negative. Just over 4,000 people were diagnosed in 2019 in the UK. So most people will receive a negative result, but if yours is positive, you can get treatment. It will mean that you can live well, and it also means that you can protect your partners or other people that you're having sex with.
Tainted Love. Tainted Love on Pride Radio.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so, it's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, I think about you. And do they know it's like I'm losing my mind? Sleepless nights, think about you. You said you loved me, or were you just being kind?
losing my mind.
1987, the UK government's Don't Die of Ignorance campaign is launched. It was hard-hitting and still looks it by today's standards.
There is now a danger that has become a threat to us all. It is a deadly disease and there is no known cure. The virus can be passed during sexual intercourse with an infected person. Anyone can get it, man or woman. So far, it's been confined to small groups. But it's spreading.
A-U. A-U. Don't be silly. Move the condom on your way. Reach in paradise.
Okay, it's 1987. Needle exchanges were first piloted in the UK. The first antiretroviral drug, AZT, is approved in the US, and HIV testing is introduced across the UK. It's also the year that Diana, Princess of Wales, opens a new ward at Middlesex Hospital for the treatment of HIV patients, shaking the hands of AIDS patients without wearing gloves.
HIV does not make people dangerous to know, so you can shake their hands and give them a hug. Heaven knows, they need it. What's more, you can share their homes, their workplaces, their playgrounds, and their toys. We all need to be alert to the special needs of those for whom AIDS is the last straw in an already heavy burden of discrimination and misfortune. For our children's sake, we need to seize the opportunity to plan our response and organise our defences while we still have time.
. 1988 was the first World AIDS Day. World AIDS Day takes place on the 1st of December each year. It's an opportunity for people worldwide to unite in the fight against HIV, to show support for people living with HIV, and to commemorate those who have died from an AIDS-related illness. Founded in 1988, World AIDS Day was the first ever Global Health Day. Over 103,800 people are living with HIV in the UK. Globally, there are an estimated 38 million people who have the virus. Despite the virus only being identified in 1984, more than 35 million people have died of HIV or AIDS, making it one of the most destructive pandemics in history. Today, scientific advances have been made in HIV treatment. There are laws to protect people living with HIV, and we understand so much more about the condition. Despite this, every year in the UK, over 4,450 people are diagnosed with HIV. People do not know the facts about how to protect themselves and others, and the stigma and discrimination remain a reality for many people living with the condition. World AIDS Day is important because it reminds the public and local government that HIV has not gone away. There is still a vital need to raise money, increase awareness, fight prejudice, and improve education. As men in the UK and around the world felt shame for the gay cancer, as it was known, there were allies of the disease. Firstly, from across the pond by international artists. In 1989, Madonna released the album Like a Prayer, which included a card insert called The Facts About AIDS. It also paid tribute to her former roommate Martin Borgoyne, who died of AIDS-related complications in 1986, aged just 23. The leaflet referred to AIDS as an equal opportunity disease. It went on to say, "People with AIDS, regardless of their sexual orientation, deserve compassion and support, not violence or bigotry." Three simple facts followed, explaining how you could get HIV, and then an equally simple message telling you to wear a condom. Madonna would ultimately teach gay men more about sex than they would ever learn in school. "AIDS is no party," the leaflet signed off with, and Madonna was only too aware. The Madison Square Garden show of her Who's That Girl tour in 1987 became an AIDS benefit, with money raised going to the American Foundation for AIDS Research.
Suddenly, everyone was talking about gay cancer, the disease that gay people deserved. It was on every headline. It was on every news show. I saw people starting to behave differently towards people who were HIV positive or who had AIDS. Not wanting to shake their hands or eat chips out of the same bowl or touch the same doorknob. It made me sad. It made me feel sick. It made me want to kick everybody's ass. I started to do, well, what some people perceive to be outrageous things. I went to St. Vincent's Hospital. I heard there was a whole ward of men and women dying of AIDS. When I arrived, I felt like I had entered a concentration camp. Emaciated bodies in every bed, and all these people who had been abandoned by their families and their friends and their loved ones.
In 1990, the BBC soap opera EastEnders runs a storyline raising awareness of the condition. It was watched by millions and really shone a light on the disease. This is the dramatic scene in the Queen Vic between Mark Fowler and Peggy Mitchell.
What the hell are you doing here?
We're having a drink.
Oh, no, you're not. You're leaving right now. Look, this is my pub. I say who drinks in here and who doesn't. Now get out of here before I have the law on you.
Why are you doing this? What have I ever done to you?
You know.
No, I don't.
You've got AIDS, Mark. And I won't have that sort of thing in my pub.
Stonewall is a lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender rights charity in the United Kingdom. Named after the 1969 Stonewall riots in New York City's Greenwich Village. It is the largest LGBT plus rights organisation in Europe and was formed in 1989 by political activists and others lobbying against Clause 28 of the Local Government Act. Its founders include Sir Ian McKellen, Lisa Power, MBE, and Lord Cashman, CBE. Stonewall still operates Switchboard, which is a helpline which aimed to provide an information, support and referral service for lesbians, gay men, bisexual and trans people, and anyone who needs to consider issues around their sexuality.
We used to get calls on the line from people who were terrified that they had syphilis or gonorrhea, and it was a mental health thing, that they felt so guilty about the sexual act that they had participated in that they couldn't believe they didn't have a sexually transmitted infection.
Joining me now is the international drag artist and actor David Dale.
There was an article in the newspaper about a gay plague and that a couple of gay people had died in America. this was about 1981, 82. So it's quite early on. There was a kind of group of us. There was about 12 of us in our group. We were all really, really close. And then one of them, a guy called Ostrich, who was called Ostrich because he was 7 foot tall and dead skinny. He looked like an ostrich. And he said just off the cuff one day, "Oh, it's not going to come over here. None of, we'll be all right. We'll be fine." And then within 3 weeks, I'd heard he died. And that's when it really hit me, I think. And then slowly, my friends were dropping off like flies. At that time, I was in a relationship, so I didn't sort of put it about, if you look for want of a better expression. But,
yeah,
you know, thinking on, you didn't really need to put it about. You just had to go with that one unlucky person. It certainly wasn't a case of being promiscuous. Yeah. It was like a Russian roulette, really. It didn't have anything to do with the amount of people you slept with. It had to do with just that one person that passed it on to you. What made it even more scary for me was my partner and I, we were together for 19 years. And at one point in the mid-80s, in 1988, we split up for 6 months. And during that time, he contracted AIDS, HIV, rather. And he died in 1996 after nearly 20 years together. So again, it was just a one-off thing. He met some guy, he got it, and he died. All our mob were dropping like flies, and you'd go into a pub where you'd all meet up and you'd say, "Where's so-and-so?" "Oh, he's dead." And it was very off the cuff because, as I say, people were going at a fast rate of knots, and people that you saw regularly in the bar that I used to go to called the Black Cap in Camden Town in London, we'd ask for certain people, and there were other people would say, "Well, we've no idea what happened to him. He may be dead because we know he had no family, and we know he had AIDS, and so he could have been, for all we know, he could have been in a morgue somewhere and been there for months. We just didn't know. No one knew where these people went. So it was a horrendous time, really.
And what was the general sort of feeling from other members of the gay community when they would find out that somebody had the virus?
We didn't know what it was. No one knew where it came from. No one knew what it was. No one knew how to deal with it. Hence, in that programme, It's a Sin, that was recently on, you know, people wearing rubber gloves and burning their clothes and putting things into carrier bags. We did all that because we didn't know how you could get it. We just knew one day you got it and the next day you were dead. And in the 80s, no one seemed to care. There was lots of things on TV about the gay plague and gays were dying and a wrath of God and all this kind of stuff. And no one really did anything about it until the drag queens got off their backsides and started to raise money for doing charity events for people that had no relatives or no one to look after them who were dying of AIDS. And we sort of, you know, gang together and put on charities and raise loads and loads and loads of money for AIDS causes. But of course, in those days, we didn't know what HIV was. There was no HIV.
Yeah.
It was just AIDS. You either had it and you're dead, and that was it in the early days. And that was the scary part, really. I went to visit a friend of mine, Russell, in hospital, and there's a scene from It's a Sin that really hit home for me. And it's a scene, I don't know if you've seen it or if you remember
it. Yeah, of course.
But he was locked into a ward, and then you literally had to put on protection clothes from head to toe. And he had his food left outside the door. Now, if there was no one there to bring the food in, he would have to get out of bed, stagger to the door, knock on the door. They'd unlock the door and they'd very gingerly kick the tray into the room so we could pick it up. And then they'd lock the door again. I actually witnessed that with my friend Russell. I had to literally pick up his food and bring it to his bed. It was horrendous.
But just take you back to the whole sort of period of time with, you know, Margaret Thatcher and the Tories bringing in the whole, you know, Section 28 thing.
28.
What was your thoughts at the time around that?
My thoughts on Margaret Thatcher and Clause 28, I just thought the woman was the devil incarnate, to be honest. You know, I've always fought for gay rights my whole life. The fact that she had the nerve to bring this in, you know, no promotion of homosexuality, which also meant that we could not do anything about the AIDS crisis because she wasn't allowing us to. She washed her hands of it, basically. And I'm going to say this, even though it's going to be quite controversial, I'd even go as far as to say it wasn't until straight people started dying of it that anyone bothered to do anything about it. So as far as Margaret Thatcher goes, I think she was a monster. And I do not understand gay men that vote Tory
So how do you think things have changed now? They have changed massively.
It has changed drastically for the good, but I get very annoyed at people's flippancy of it. You know, a lot of young guys, they go, oh, well, you know, I might have it, but it's fine. I'll just take some pep and I'll be all right, blah, blah, blah. It's almost like they don't really care anymore. Mm. And I think that's why It's a Sin is such an important program, because it's all right for me and my era. We sit and watch it in absolute horror because it just digs up so many memories. For me, I put all those things that had happened to me in the 80s in a box and put it under my bed, and I didn't want to have to open that box ever again. But to watch It's a Sin took the lid off of the box, and I was forced to relive everything. And I must admit, for a couple of days after watching it, I was very, very down. But for, I think, a lot of young people now, they do need to watch it, because I think they take HIV and AIDS in their stride. I think people think, because it's not as out there as it used to be, that it's gone away, and it hasn't. It's still there, very, very much still there. And I think people need to stop being so flippant about it and remember that, you know, it could happen to anybody. I mean, Paul O'Grady and me, we were going, not that I've dropped that name, but we were good friends. We were going to funerals on a daily basis. Right. We would have a diary, and instead of having our book into the diary, we'd have Monday, Russell's funeral, Tuesday, Simon's funeral, Wednesday, Alan's funeral. And that's what it was like for years. And it was horrendous. It got to the point where I was so sad about going to funerals, I refused to go to any more. And I remember saying to Savage, the next funeral I'm going to go to will be my own. I'm not going to any more funerals. It was just too much. And we were like chief mourners. We were every funeral. And I thought, I can't do this anymore. And I didn't.
Yeah.
Dawn of the AIDS epidemic, when no one knew how the disease spread and diagnosis was considered terminal, the nurses defied convention, found an innovative way to improve care and treated AIDS patients with compassion.
I went into that profession to help people, regardless of what that person was going through. Someone did once say to me, "Not frightened that they bite you," and I was absolutely horrified. I said, "Why would someone bite me?"
Looking from a window, it's like a story of a dog. Can you hear me? Came back only yesterday, moving further away. Won't you hear me? All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all
you were keeping that secret with them. You know, people would say, "Oh, well, what's the matter with them? You know, so what have they died of?" And they were happy to tell lies, keeping the secret. And can you imagine how that must feel? Absolutely horrendous.
It was a bit like a war zone, because it was so full on. There was never quiet moments. You were always doing something.
In my profession, you don't really hug people, but you hugged people, and it was lovely.
All I needed was the love you gave.
You know, you'd say, "See you in the morning," and you come in and the bed's empty. And you knew they hadn't gone home. They'd died in the night.
It was horrendous, just awful death. And he lay there screaming, "Don't tell my mother I died of AIDS." It was just pitiful and horrible.
All you could do was to know that you were able to nurse them to a good death. And that wasn't always possible, because perhaps sometimes they hadn't accepted that they were going to die.
All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all I ever knew, only you.
Queen frontman Freddie Mercury died at home on November the 24th, 1991.
just hours after releasing a brave statement confirming he was HIV positive. Why did he keep it a secret for so long? He had become a recluse in the last 2 years of his life, secluded himself behind the tall brick walls of his home. You know, when I was a DJ in the clubs in Newcastle in the 1990s, HIV in its progressive state was taboo. I had a friend whose best mate had AIDS. He would later become my friend too. Over the years, I saw him deteriorate. I would always kiss his cheek when I saw him. He would tell me not to, as he was conscious about physical signs of the virus displayed on his neck and face. I'd still kiss him. I would ask myself how I would feel if I was him, how I would want others to feel about me if I were in his shoes. As a young gay man, I could have never been as resilient as him. When I look back on Ian, I think of a brave and fortunate, genuine, funny bloke who in many ways saved me at a time when I could have been wild, promiscuous, arrogant, or simply just unlucky. I was young and it was all just a big party. He was there as a physical sign of another outcome, a visible deterrent that every new experience I had could lead me to where he was there and then. I'll always remember him as someone who changed my life and made a difference to me personally. An inspiration. Having HIV or AIDS is no different to any other illness. We are all flesh and blood. We have all loved and need to be loved. We were all once babies who developed and grew through the love and comfort of a mother at our most vulnerable time. Truth is, we never lose that vulnerability. When all is not as we would like it to be, we all just want someone to put their arms around us, give us a kiss on the cheek and tell us that it's going to be okay. Back in the 80s, a lot of families disowned their children because they were gay, not to mention having the virus. Through the development of medications and the fight from our ancestry and the evolution of diversity through the tireless efforts of our rainbow community, we have that. From civil partnerships to marriage, the timeless efforts of our people have steadily educated the world to the diversity and inclusion of our community. The journey is far from over. We've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. More and more from outside of our family are starting to accept that the love that we offer other human beings is far from tainted. We are all human beings. Whether you're straight, gay, bi, trans, non-binary, or whatever you identify as. We are all on the road to self-discovery every day. Look after each other and be safe. Sometimes I feel like throwing my hands up in the air. I know I can count on you. Sometimes I feel like saying, Lord, I just don't care. But you've got the love I need to see me through. Sometimes it seems the going is just too rough. To all of my guests for talking honestly and letting me bring up their difficult memories. I'm Stu Smith, and this was co-written by myself and Tony Mack. This was produced by Tony Mack. Call out.
Tainted Love on Pride Radio.